knowledge of the fortune hidden in the gowns, and therefore of Mr. Lauderback's blackmail. "There has been no mention of the orange gown from any quarter," said Gascoigne. "One would think Mrs. Wells might have been more active in its recovery, had Anna told her that it was stowed beneath my bed." "Presumably Miss Wetherill believes the gold was paid out to Mr. Mannering as she instructed."
"Yes, presumably," Gascoigne said.
"But wouldn't you suppose that in that case Mrs. Wells would pay a call upon Mannering to see about recovering it? There's no want of love between them. She and Mannering are old friends from gambling days. No, I think it far more possible that Mrs. Wells remains entirely ignorant about the orange gown, and about all the others."
"Hmm," said Moody.
"Mannering won't touch it," Gascoigne said, "for fear of what will happen down the line. And I'm certainly not going to take it to the bank. So there it stays, under my bed."
"Have you had it valued?"
"Yes, though unofficially. Mr. Frost came by to look it over. Somewhere in the neighbourhood of £120, he thought."
"Well, I hope for Miss Wetherill's sake that she has not confided in Mrs. Wells," Moody said. "I dread to think how Mrs. Wells might respond to such a revelation behind closed doors. She would only blame Anna for the loss of the fortune, I'm sure of it."
Suddenly Gascoigne put down his fork.
"I've just had a thought," he said. "The money in the dresses became the money in the cottage. So if the widow's appeal goes through, and she receives the fortune as her inheritance, she'll get it all back, less the money in the orange gown, of course. She'll end up where she started, after all."
"In my experience, people are rarely contented to end up where they started," Moody said. "If my impression of Lydia Wells is accurate, I think that she will feel very bitter about Anna's having been in possession of those dresses, no matter what Anna's intentions might have been, and no matter what the outcome. But we are fairly certain that Anna did not even know about the gold she was carrying, at least not until very recently."
"Mr. Gascoigne," Moody said, holding up his hand, "despite my youth, I possess a certain store of wisdom about the fairer sex, and I can tell you categorically that women do not like it when other women wear their clothes without their asking." Gascoigne laughed. Cheered by this joke, he applied himself to finishing his luncheon with a renewed energy and a good humour. The truth of Moody's observation notwithstanding, it must be owned that his store of wisdom, as he had termed it, could be called empirical only in that it had been formed upon the close observation of his late mother, his stepmother, and his two maternal aunts. To put it plainly, Moody had never taken a lover, and did not know a great deal about women, save for how to address them properly, and how to dote upon them as a nephew and as a son. It was not despite the natural partialities of youth that the compass of Moody's worldly experience was scarcely larger than a keyhole, through which he had perceived, metaphorically speaking, only glimpses of the shadowed chamber of adulthood that lay beyond. In fact, he had met with ample opportunity to widen this aperture, and indeed to unlock the door altogether and pass through it into that most private and solitary of rooms. But he had declined these opportunities with quite the same discomfort and stiff propriety with which he fielded Gascoigne's rhetorical teases now. When he was 21, a late night of carousing in London had led him, by the usual methods and channels, to a lamplit courtyard not far from Smithfield Market. This courtyard, by the authority of Moody's college chums, was frequented by the most fashionable of whores, so identifiable for their red Garibaldi jackets, brass-buttoned, that were the height of Parisian fashion at the time, and alarming to English ladies for that reason. Although the military style of their jackets gave the women a deliberate and brazen look, they pretended at shyness, turning away so they might look at the men over the rounded curve of their shoulders, and faint, and titter, and point their toes. Moody, watching them, felt suddenly sad. He could not help but think of his father, For how many times over the years of Moody's youth had he come across the man in some dark corner of the house to perceive upon his father's lap a perfect stranger? She would be gasping unnaturally, or squealing like a pig, or speaking in a high-pitched voice that was not her own, and she would leave behind her always that same greasy musk, the smell of the theatre. Moody's college chums were pooling their sovereigns and cutting straws to draw for the first pick. Silently, he withdrew from the courtyard, hailed a hansom, and retired to bed. It was a point of pride for him thereafter that he would not do as his father had done, that he would not fall prey to his father's vices, that he would be the better man. And yet, how easy it might have been to contribute his sovereign and select his straw and choose one of the red-shirted ladies to follow into the cobbled alcove on the dark side of the church. His college chums supposed him to have set his sights upon a clerical vocation. They were surprised some years later when Moody enrolled at the Inner Temple and began to study for the bar. It was therefore with a very well-concealed ignorance that Moody played interlocutor to Gascoigne and Clinch and Mannering and Pritchard and all the others when they spoke of Anna Wetherill and the esteem in which they held her as a whore. Moody's well-timed murmurs of naturally and of course and exactly so, combined with a general rigidity of posture whenever Anna's name was mentioned, implied to these men merely that Moody was made uncomfortable by the more candid truths of human nature, and that he preferred, like most men of exalted social rank, to keep his earthly business to himself. We observe that one of the great attributes of discretion is that it can mask ignorance of all the most common and lowly varieties, and Walter Moody was nothing if not excessively discreet. The truth was that he had never spoken two words together to a woman of Anna Wetherill's profession or experience, and would hardly know how to address her, or upon what subject, should the chance arise. "And of course," he said now, "we ought to be cheered by the fact that Miss Wetherill's trunk did not follow her to the wayfarer's fortune."
"Did it not?" said Gascoigne, in surprise.
"No. The lead-lined dresses remain at the gridiron, along with her pipe and her opium lamp and other miscellaneous items. She never sent for them."
"And Mr. Clinch has not raised the issue?"
"No," said Moody. "It is cheering, I think. Whatever role Miss Wetherill played in Mr. Steyne's disappearance, and whatever role she is to play in the ridiculous séance this evening, we can at least be fairly certain that she has not confided in Mrs. Wells absolutely.